You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of the RhinoCast. We have a great show for you today, as always. Starting things off is Bob Lefsetz. Then after that, we're going to have part two of our exclusive interview with Mike Nesmith of the Monkees. And then after that, finishing things off, we are going to have an interview with John Densmore, world-famous drummer of The Doors. So stay tuned.
Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz here on the weekly RhinoCast. I'm featuring one of my favorite bands of all time, The Silencers. You probably don't even know what The Silencers are. You think it's some kind of punk band, but you would be wrong. In the spring of 1989, not long after my ex-wife, although she was an ex-wife at that time, moved out. I'm giving you a little chronology here. Chronology. How do you like that word? A couple of guys who knew me from the Chrysalis days that I only corresponded with. This is back in the days before email. They only corresponded with them in regular mail. They came to L.A. They tracked me down. Daniel Glass was one of them. Another one was this guy, Kevin Sutter. They'd both moved on from Chrysalis, and Kevin Sutter worked for RCA. And the nature of going out with a promo guy is they bullshit with you, they slap your back, you go to dinner, you have a lot of laughs, and then you got to listen to the music. That's the payment. That's how you pay for dinner. And he puts in a cassette, a sampler cassette, and he plays me that track. And I go, that's fucking great. You know, I'm saying that because I really believe it. That's The Real McCoy by The Silencers from their second album, A Blues for Buddha. He gave me the sampler cassette. I had him send a CD. I love that CD. There's another song that it opens up with that he didn't play me, but I discovered on the CD called Answer Me that I played every morning for months. It really inspired me. And getting so into this second Silencers' album, A Blues for Buddha, I had them send me the first, which actually they had to get from Germany. They didn't have one on hand. And that's the one you may know. It's called A Letter from St. Paul, Because of Painted Moon. Got a little airplay, Painted Moon. You know, when they sent me the CD and I heard that, I go, oh, I know that track. This was just before all the AOR died in the 80s. And I love Blues for Buddha so much. I would write about it and talk about it. You know, I had this feeling that there were two records that I loved in 89 that I really see as 90s records, but they came out in 89, which was Blues for Buddha and Sean Colvin's debut record. I thought that I could sell those out of the trunk of my car. If I just played them for somebody, they would ultimately love it. And people would get in my car, and I would play them these Silencers records. I don't even do that anymore. I don't even people subject people to that. Let me give you another one. This is I Ought to Know. You know, these songs immediately get in your heart. I'm playing them here next to Celine. Celine's body's immediately moving as soon as the first note begins. That's this kind of music. It used to be so different. This was prior to Kurt Cobain, when we had the great bifurcation between rock and noise. What I mean by that is not that Kurt Cobain was noise. This just made it say, okay, punk is the only thing that people want to listen to. So punk and speed metal became the rule for rock. No wonder the boy bands came in, because who could listen to this stuff? You know, these guitars that are like banging you over the head. Where now this music, like the Silencers, is seen as quaint. This music ruled for two decades, from like 1970 to 1990. You know, some of these records I talk about, like Phil Collins' first solo album, you know, it was about the music. It wasn't about an assault. It wasn't about an intellectual thing. It wasn't about an attitude. The music just made you feel good, and you listened. I'm going to build up here. I'm going to play another song, you know, because all these songs are so fantastic. God's Gift. What is that sound? It sounds like something religious. I would always talk about the Silencers, and I went to Canada, where they know more about music than anybody else in the world. Maybe because, you know, it's cold up there. Maybe because there are fewer people. It's not about attitude. It's not about emotion. It's about who you are. It's not about the hierarchy. And Bobby Gale told me, oh, that's Fingerprints. I had seen, you remember Fingerprints that ended with a Z instead of an S? They were on Virgin. Who even knew that it was the same guy, Jimmy O'Neill? And Jimmy O'Neill was from Scotland. And the Silencers were a little different. And then the Silencers went through a few changes. The second album was done by Flood. This was before, you know, he became so famous for working with all the other English acts as a producer. But some of the same songs that Fingerprints did, ultimately, the Silencers redid. Now, I'm going to play my favorite song from A Letter from St. Paul, Blue Desire.
Here comes blue desire.
sound. It's a magical sound. The music exists completely separate from society. That's what I love about it. It takes you immediately on a journey, and it swings. It makes you feel good. It kind of gets like a rubber band going deep inside your heart. Now, the title track of A Letter from St. Paul is actually an instrumental with a girl basically reading a letter in the beginning. But I'll start with the instrumental part. Now, ultimately, the Silencers regrouped, had different producers, and never really made it. They were big in France. It sounds like a cliche, like Jerry Lewis. But they were really big in France, and they would tour France, and the record company wouldn't want to fund them anymore. And then that was the end of the story. I was constantly waiting for the Silencers to break. But it didn't happen. But one of the great things about my life now is if I write about somebody, you hear from them. Charlie Gillett, famous DJ in the UK, also wrote a book about Atlantic Records and put out that record, you know, that the iTunes Music Store used in an advertisement, you know, ready for number one. I always said it would be a great hit on the radio, and it never really happened. But he connected me with Jimmy O'Neill. Jimmy O'Neill is in, you know, France, living in France where his fans are and making records with his kids. And finally, he's got a MySpace site. And that's one of the reasons I bring up, I'm trying to bring this music back alive. It's not about the stories I'm telling here. It's purely about the music and the stories you create in the mind. Go to, you know, Google MySpace and the Silencers, and you will find this. You'll find Painted Moon, three other tracks, and you can relive the great experience I had for the 89 up through the 90s. Got me through a very rough time, and it's great to be able to reconnect with this music. And I'll leave you with a final track from A Letter from St. Paul, Possessed, Because That's What I Am, by Jimmy O'Neill and the Silencers Music. Till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz on the Rhinocast.
Welcome to part two of Monkeys.com and Rhino.com's exclusive interview with Michael Nesmith. During our conversation, Michael recalled the final original Monkeys tour that he took part in 1969, in which they were backed by an R&B band known as Sam and the Good Timers.
Who knew what we were going to do? I mean, we couldn't, you know, in terms of sustaining ourselves as a band, it just wasn't, that wasn't in the cards. You know, the musical pressures and influences were just too different, so working in front of a band was an obvious thing, but to work in front of a band that could kind of play everything, all the way from Mickey's R&B to David's Broadway stuff, and handle a little bit of the rock and roll stuff, was, you know, that's when we thought, well, we'll try, you know, maybe we just get ourselves a good R&B band that can play all this stuff. And Sam and the Good Timers came to be Rhythm and Bubblegum.
Couldn't leave.
wasn't as ironic, of course, as Hendrix opening for us, but it was ironic. And we got a job playing in Mexico, and we played, I think, in Guadalajara or someplace, a giant bull ring down there. When I say giant, I don't know how really giant it was. You know, just everything is armor corded these days. And you look back and you think, yeah, it was the size of Pennsylvania. But it was, I don't know how actually big it was. But we went there. Sam and the Good Timers were backing us up. Nobody came. The place was empty. Not one person. Oh, well, maybe there were 12. But this place set, you know, it looked like it had room for 250,000 people in there. And I don't know what the promoter was thinking.
Some people always complain their life is too short.
Monkees' performance at the Plaza Monumental on Sunday, the 27th of July, 1969, was just a side trip for their primary appearances that took place in Mexico City at the Forum nightclub, promoted by Javier Castro, whose daughter was reportedly a huge Monkees fan.
You know what? I think to this day, I believe it was her birthday. I think that's what was going on with that club. Jerry Parencio was our agent at the time, and he charged this guy some exorbitant sum just to make him go away, and he paid it. He paid it, and then Jerry made him bring it to the United States in a briefcase in cash, and he brought it. So we had to go.
Despite the lucrative nature of the performances in Mexico City, the trip did not pass without incident for Michael Nesbitt.
I had my camera. I had gotten a new Nikon, and I was there was a demonstration outside. These busloads of Mexican soldiers came and surrounded the town square, and coming down the street was this huge riot crowd with banners and yelling slogans, you know, advancing on these guys. And I started taking pictures because I thought, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Well, actually, nothing did happen. They never made it to the town square, and I don't think anything happened. But later that night, I got this knock on the door. And these two guys were standing up and said, "We're Agent so-and-so, Agent 39 and 47. They gave me two numbers. And they pushed their way past me and pushed their way in the room. And they took my camera and took the film out of it and left with it. So I told the club owner about it. And he was incensed. He said, "What? This is terrible. I'm going to check into this." Of course, this is a much different Mexico than it is now. I mean, it was, you know, this was the 60s, and things were wildly different. So we got back from the show that night, which was, you know, I guess 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going by the desk. This guy waves at me from the desk, and he said, "Here's your film back." And there's my film can, and it had a little note underneath it and said, "We're sorry for the inconvenience, you know, Agents 37 and 49. And there was the film back in the can. I thought, boy, this club owner's got some real pull. Yeah, I don't know who these guys were, but he really must be. So I get up to the room. I go in the room, and now here comes a knock on the door again. Bang, bang, bang. Open. It's the same two guys. And they said, "Did you get your film back?" I said, "Yeah." And thank you. So, "Well, we're really sorry. And, you know, we don't mean to cause any trouble. And please forgive us if." And I said, "Well, I it's fine. I wasn't upset. I, as a matter of fact, I sort of understood what you were doing. I didn't like it, but I wasn't surprised or shocked." And they said, "Well, here's a little token of our apology." And they handed me I think it was like a sock, like a white sock or something, and obviously full of herb. So I kind of looked at it, and that's when David Pearl was there, and he was standing by me, and they said, "So here you go," and they held it out, and I didn't want to take it, and so David took it and said, "Thank you," and then they walked away, and I said, "Is that grass, David?" And he opened it up, and looked at it, smelled it, and he said, "Yeah, it sure is." And I said, "Well, what are we going to do with it?" He said, "I don't know." He walked out. We never took it into the room. Walked out to a to a seat, you know, like a love seat or something. It was sitting in the hallway of this big atrium in this hotel. It was the big, like, Mexico Plaza Hotel or something like that. And he lifted up the seat and just poured the entire contents of this sock full of grass out underneath the seat in that hotel. We just left it there. And I think he tossed the sock over the railing or something. So, oh boy. And then I, you know, I never heard any more about it. But that, yeah, that's the story of the great taking pictures of the riot.
We'd like to do a new one for you now called She's So Far Out, She's In.
The Monkees' 1969 jaunt was, of course, a far cry from their record-setting 1967 summer tour.
Well, that was the big tour. That was like 53 or 56 dates or something, and we set house records, and that was the that's what I call the big tube. We started off in it was all limos and private plane and then hotel, then the stadium, then the hotel, then the limo, then the private plane, and it was just, one big, long corridor that just went on and on and on interminably. But that was the summer of love.
You guys were number two for the entire summer. You had the number two album right under Sgt. Pepper.
With no airplay.
Right, you had no single off the album.
I was always under the impression that the FM guys had just banded together, kind of like the Hall of Famers, and had just said, "No, they don't deserve this. We're not going to play any more Monkees music." Anyway, yeah, '67 was the big year. That was the one I remember.
The Monkees outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in 1967.
And you think that's true?
I do think it's true, but
amazing.
But, that's based on the fact that the Monkees had four number one albums all in the course of about 18 months.
We hope that disproves some rumors.
They had three number one records at that point. Wow. Who knew where all that money and those records went? Gosh, have no idea.
After citing some further facts and figures for Nez, conversation soon turned to the new reissues of Headquarters and Pisces Aquarius. He wondered, is that it? Could the gold mine of Monkees Audio now be at its end?
You think that's probably it too, right? I mean, I don't know how can't mine any more out of that Monkees than you already have. I don't think, Andrew. I think it's all done. Don't you?
Is that? Do you feel that way?
Listen to you. Listen to you laugh. Yeah, I think you are. You in there digging around?
I'm gonna try and do Head. A special edition of Head. What do you think about that?
I think that's a good idea. Head was an interesting record. That's we'll have to sit and I'll give you the blow by blow of me and Jack Nicholson mixing that record.
Really? I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, sure. That's a great story. That was me and Jack at our craziest.
And I'd like a glass of cold gravy with a hair in it, please.
There are some nice tunes on there.
And so ends part two of my conversation with Michael Nesmith here on Monkees.com and Rhino.com. I ask you to join me for the final part three, coming up right here.
This is Melinda Newman, and I'm talking with legendary drummer John Densmore. His group, Tribal Jazz, is playing at the Skirball Cultural Center as part of its free Sunset Concert Series. The concert's at 8 p.m. this Thursday. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm great. Legendary doesn't imply I'm dead, I hope.
No, not at all. No, we're just trying to give you the respect you're due, but we're expecting still many, many, many more great years and great things from you.
Yeah. Well, I'm very much alive and looking to the future. I really love playing with these jazz musicians that are half my age.
Well, they keep you young.
they do.
So I want to talk about tribal jazz because I was reading that it actually came together when, speaking of young, you were at a music program fundraiser at your son's school, and that's where you met Art Ellis, your partner in crime in tribal jazz.
This is correct. You know, the administration of the last few years are cutting the arts, and they don't know that if you study music, it improves your math. If you look at musical notation, it's just math with feeling. So I was doing a benefit at the school because they cut the music, and met Art Ellis, and tribal jazz was born. And we subsequently added some African drummers and expanded, and now I'm real happy.
Now, what kind of kinship did you feel with him? Why did you think, all right, I'm ready to go into the breach with this guy?
Well, because we both had the same appreciation of sort of old school jazz, a la Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and me being a drummer, I'm very interested in that, and he loves African drumming and knew some musicians, and I knew some, and so we put this synthesis together of sort of a jazz quartet and African drumming. So when we play, towards the end of the evening, people, because of the drumming, tend to get up and move around, so it's pretty fun. It's not just a sit-down jazz thing.
So you're telling people they better bring their dancing shoes?
Well, they're going to be forced to.
Dancing, mandatory.
We go through the audience drumming. You know, you can't sit down.
It would seem to be impossible to, and definitely impolite, quite honestly. I'm a Southerner, and it would strike me as impolite to not get up and move if y'all are making the effort. You know, I thought it was very interesting. I was reading a quote from you where you said that you've been saying for 30 years you're a jazz drummer. What's the difference between a jazz drummer and a rock drummer?
Oh, wow. Well, that's quite a... I'm stumped. Jazz drummers... I got so much from jazz, the way Coltrane's drummer Elvin played with him. I think it influenced the way I played with Jim Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of subliminal, hard to say. But jazz has a lot of improvisation, and rock does not have quite as much. And technically, jazz musicians are pretty proficient. So I'm always trying to get my hands to go faster. But I think the improvisation is the difference, really.
You know, you talk a lot about how you were able to use a bossa nova beat, like you were able to bring certain jazz elements into the Doors, like on Break On Through. And I think most of us never even realized that's what you were doing. You were kind of educating us in that way. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that came about?
Yeah, it was 1965 or 6 when bossa nova, the Brazilian music, came up to the States, and everybody was infatuated with Antonio Carlos Jobim, and it was actually a girl from Ipanema. Da, 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 that has a bossa nova feel, and I practiced that, and then I thought, wow, I'm going to make it stiffer in this rock band, The Doors, but still get this sort of different flavor. So hence we get Break On Through.
Then I was looking at your record on Hidden Beach, and you guys take some Door songs where you redo Break On Through, and then you also take Riders on the Storm and do a salsa version of it.
That's true. I hate to correct you. We didn't do Break On Through. We did Riders on the Storm twice, but we did it once as a salsa, and we call it Los Tormentas, which means the storm. And so I have a lot of fun on stage, and I say, okay, we're going to do our one and only Token Doors song, but it's instrumental, and it's disguised as a salsa, and you're going to have to guess what the name is. And then I play a little rain stick. I don't know if you know what that is. It sounds like rain. And then we go into this salsa. It's quite fun. And then the other one is, we call it Riders on the Storm. It's a flute version, and I acquired Jim's vocal from the original track, which the engineer and I had this idea that Jim should whisper the whole thing, you know, Riders on the Storm, under his main vocal. And that actually is on the record, but very subliminal. And we got a hold of that and stuck it under the flute. So if you listen to the original now with that knowledge, folks, you'll hear the whisper, but it's so subtle that if you didn't know that, you wouldn't notice it.
See, it is an educational program, not just an entertaining one that you're listening to. And it sounds like the rest of your material is reworking of arts material, right, that you've taken and, like you said, combined a jazz and world beat and fusion to
it. Yes. Art is primarily the melody writer, and that's what attracted me to his tunes. They're real accessible melodies, and I have a big mouth about arranging. I was always telling everybody what to do in the Doors. Even though I didn't know how to say, you know, we should go to E flat, due to playing in the orchestra in high school and the marching band, I have a sense of we need a guitar solo, we need a bridge, we need to modulate. So I got together with Art, just the two of us, and we really went through all these arrangements, and then we got these incredible musicians.
Which I definitely want to talk about them. Your two drummers are from Senegal, correct?
One is from Senegal and one is from Benin, but he lived in Paris most of the time. So they're both African drummers, master players. And the one from Senegal is a master African dancer who teaches here in L.A. Hence, at the end of the evening, he's going to get up from his drums and start hopping around, and it gets rather infectious.
I'm telling you, people, bring your boogie shoes with you on Thursday. Let's talk about those rhythms. Were those rhythms difficult for you to learn to play? Because they're quite different from American rhythms.
Well, as I said, Art and I arranged the songs and had African rhythms in mind, but it was sort of in the format of our song. So they kind of had to fit a little more into what we were doing, but using their indigenous ethnological instruments. Aziz Fayi is the drummer from Senegal. He plays the sabar drums, which are little sort of wood drums with animal skins hit with mallets, which he made himself.
So does he mass produce them in any kind of way, or does he have the only ones and it's just his?
No, he doesn't mass produce them, but there are a lot of sabar drums, but most of them are homemade.
So then everyone would sound differently?
Slightly, correct.
Do you have a favorite drum?
Well, the traps, which is the slang name for the drum set. Here's some more education. In New Orleans, the bands had the drums split up. A guy in the street musician playing a bass drum, a snare drum, and then they were trapped together, which is the traps or the drum set. That's my instrument. All these little hand drums I can fool around on, but I leave that to the percussionists because they're so good at it.
Well, and let's talk about who else is in the band. Christina Barrio.
Yeah, let's talk about Christina. Christina's family, her father was Luciano Berio. He's like the most famous Italian composer since Puccini. And her mom, she's Armenian, a famous singer. They've both passed. But anyway, so she comes from this prestigious classical family, and then she lived in Brazil 15 years studying percussion and playing with Sarah Vaughan, so she's good.
Wow. And how did you find her?
L.A. is a network of great musicians, you know, and the word gets around, and that's how it happened.
Because I am curious as to how you did put tribal jazz together. Is it just a matter of word of mouth gets out that you're starting, that you and Art are starting this collective, and it's let's
well,
just
we
see
knew we wanted
in?
A percussionist. We knew we wanted some African drummers, so, you know, it wasn't just the word getting out. We knew specifically what we wanted, so then you go and kind of ask around, and you find people.
You know, we're talking about a lot of different rhythms. Were there some rhythms when you were growing up, like you mentioned Jobim? You know, and Girl from Ipanema. Were there other musicians that when you were growing up really influenced you, or as the Doors were in their heyday, that have kind of led you to this point?
Yeah, I was a jazz snob, and I got my fake ID in Tijuana so I could play in bars, and I could go to Shelley's Manhole, and I saw all the greatest jazz musicians. I mean, I sat right next to Art Blakey, and I saw John Coltrane many times at Miles Davis. And then I saw these mop tops on television, you know, and I thought, what is this? Are they gay? What is this? And, you know, I got onto the Beatles and went, well, rock and roll's pretty cool. So maybe I can incorporate some of my jazz into rock and roll, which I tried to do. But I never made a jazz album, per se. And now, as I said, after 30 years, I'm putting my sticks where my mouth has been.
But, you know, when you think about it, like in the 50s, like the Beatles weren't here yet. Yes, we had Elvis. But the rock stars, in a way, were the jazz musicians. I mean, you think about like Buddy Rich and people like that. They were rock stars. Gene Krupa?
Yeah, true. Buddy Rich and, yeah, Gene Krupa, those guys were great.
You know, I mean, so it would seem understandable that that's where a lot of people would get their influences, because we didn't really have modern-day rock stars yet.
Well, rock star, we never, even the Doors, that's kind of co-opting. We the idea of star wasn't our, we wanted to make great music, and we loved the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and now they're called rock stars. I mean, that's some kind of energy drink now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
we had nothing to do with that.
No. Everyone can be a rock star, or at least they can hold the bottle at this now these days.
I think the byline is party like a rock star. Okay. I mean, we didn't set out to party. We set out to make great music. Although Jim did party enough to check out early, but...
Yes, and I would certainly say you accomplished the goal of making great music. Mission accomplished in that regard. You know, has tribal jazz played all over the world?
No, we're just getting going here.
Yeah, 'cause you guys are still pretty new. So have you played outside of the States yet?
No, we haven't. And we're looking forward to jazz festivals in Europe next summer. We just got a really good agent, so we're just getting going.
You know, what has it been like when you've been touring so far here? Are people receptive? You know, world music is not nearly as big in the U.S. as it is outside of the U.S.
I like the diversity of the audiences, all races and all ages. So, you know, the young ones get up at the end and dance, and the older jazz buffs can sit there and just groove in their seat.
Either way's fine with you, right?
Yeah.
Now, are you guys getting ready to record another album?
We're kicking around some new melodies. We need a little more time. I think in the fall we're going to get going.
Where do you see this going? Do you see this going for, you know, the next 10 years? What's your goal with tribal jazz?
Well, I mean, I love evolving as a musician, and I'm challenged by, several of these people in my band that I really think are going to be famous jazz musicians. Carlitos Del Puerto is our new bass player, and his father is the most famous Cuban bass player ever. And, oh, my God, he can play the bass like it's a little guitar or something. And so, you know, keeping up with him, as you said, is so inspiring. I'll do it as long as I can. And, you know, the goal is jazz festivals. I think we fit into the jam band world, too. And I think we could do, you know, sort of proscenium, classical kind of performing arts centers.
So we could see you anywhere, is what you're saying. You know, like Bonnaroo, you know, to to anything, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is it as much fun for you as the Doors was, or is it fun in a completely different way?
It's different. It's a completely different kind of fun. The Doors was, kind of wild. I mean, and that's what was fun but scary. I mean, Jim was so out there that it felt dangerous at times. He didn't know what was going to go on, you know. He'd throw in some new poetry, and we'd go down that road for a while. But kind of like improvising, though, you know. Like,
right. You had your own sense of improv in that.
Yeah. So I guess improvisation means the Doors or jazz being in the moment. You got to be real alert and be in the moment to see what's coming, and that's the turn on.
You know, what do you hear now that excites you? Like, are your bandmates introducing you to music that you weren't aware of before?
Well, the Africans, they play like a talking drum. I don't know if you've heard of that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drum where the little ropes are tied between the two heads, and you put it under your arm and squeeze it, and it goes talks like a person. And so we have a solo between the flute and the talking drum, and they just have a conversation, which is outrageous.
Anything else people should know about your show on Thursday?
Just, you know, that it's free. It's a beautiful outdoor evening, and I just hope people groove.
So everyone, please come to the Skirball on Thursday. The show is at 8 o'clock, and it's free, and it's tribal jazz. John, thank you so, so much.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.